Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week it is the end of the world and joining me for it is Sam Howlett.
Hello.
And no one else because they've just been killed in the apocalypse, created by Xavier Dolan's new film. That is what it's about, yes?
That's it, yeah. As the apocalypse rages outside, a young man seeks to find his family and save them.
Yep, and two of his podcast team have been killed.
Yeah.
And he has to try and bring them back. Something like that.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right. No, of course, that's not what it's about, is it?
Silly.
Oh, no. So the Enfant Terrible, as he's been known in every culture paper across the world, returns with his sixth film in 8 years, having only been born in 1989 and making us all feel like terrible, terrible people.
I mean, we do hate him, don't we?
I think that's okay, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what my therapist told me. Right. Anyway, where every day when I go in there and I go, he's making another one.
And it's still good.
Yeah. What's wrong with him? Yes, so Xavier Dolan, who took the world or can by storm in 2009 with I Killed My Mother, returns this year with... Well, it's coming out this year. It premiered last year at Cannes with It's Only the End of the World. It won the Grand Prix last year, and it is, as I said, it's his sixth film in 8 years. That was I Killed My Mother in 2009, Heartbeats in 2010, 2012, Lawrence Anyways, 2013, Tom at the Farm, 2014, Mummy, which won the jury prize, and 2016, It's Only the End of the World. And don't worry, there's already the next one in production with Kit Harington in. And yeah, so he's cranking them out. He's got as many films on there as Paul Thomas Anderson, I think. and only at the ripe old age of 28, 27.
It's just sickening, isn't it?
Yeah. So this week we have an interview with the film's director, Xavier Dolan, to play for you in a bit. But we've also got something else special for us. What's that, Sam?
Yeah, so a few weeks ago we had the 67th Berlin Film Festival, and we had two members of the Curzon head office. That's Director of Programming Damien Spandley and the Head of Marketing Kate Garover. They went to Berlin for the duration of the festival, and I'm out with them this week in London, and we had a chat about all the films that were playing, what won the awards, what they think is going to be a big hit in the UK, and what they think next year's festival might look like.
Great. And obviously with the artificial eye connection with Curzon, we can look forward to hopefully
seeing some things of those that, you know, the company has bought and are looking forward to releasing this year.
Yeah, excellent. All right. So let's begin with our podcast pitch. And this comes from my researching of Xavier Dolan that led me to the fact that he is an actor, and he's directed himself in his own films as well. But before that, he was a successful child actor, which led him to do some voice dubbing work in a niche market of Quebec French. And so Dolan became the voice of some pretty iconic characters, the best of which, I don't know if you know this, in Quebec, Xavier Dolan is Ron Weasley.
I was going to do an impression then, but I think I'm going to...
No, please do your impression.
I was going to do... It's Nimbus 2000, huh?
Yeah, it must have been exactly like that. That's spot on. I can only imagine that's exactly what he sounds like. So I will have to be seeking out a Quebec French edition of the entire Harry Potter box set. But that's for this week's podcast pitch. I wanted to ask you, we've got a number of big French actors in this film, the likes of which are Léa Seydoux, Marion Cotillard, Nathalie Bay, Vincent Cassel. If you had to cast one of these actors from this film, It's Only the End of the World, as the dubbed version of an iconic character, what character would you pick?
Well, I'm going to go for Vincent Cassel.
Right.
Because I think no one does aggression better than Vincent Cassel. Yes. If you've seen Lain or something like Black Swan or Irreversible, that's this very scary man. So I thought, you know, there's a famous scene in Lain where he's doing Taxi Driver in the mirror. So I thought, you know, dub Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle with Vincent Cassel. It's a pretty good idea. But actually, I'm going to go for Begbie from Trainspotting.
Ooh, that's actually a really neat choice.
I think it would just fit so well.
It would have to be the younger Vincent Cassel, so we'll just use the time machine.
That's fine, yeah. We can do that. Here.
Yeah. Or we could use him for T2.
Or use him for T2.
Yeah.
Renton. Oh, Renton.
Yeah, this is spot on. More of this. Okay, yeah, I can see that. So, do you think he can do any Robert Carlyle?
I mean, I can't imagine him doing Rumpelstiltskin from, what is it called? Once Upon a Time, the TV show where all the fairy tale characters... Robert Carlyle plays Rumpelstiltskin in that.
I could totally see Vincent Cassel.
Yeah, but he goes, oh, hello, dearie. That's his voice. Isn't
that? Totally Cassel. Because I was thinking Cassel as well, but I was thinking sometimes he can be a bit... He can have fun as well, I think.
Tale of Tales, he was...
I was thinking him as in a young Cassel. Yeah. It could be a grizzled older one, as in Indiana Jones. Because in the middle of the action...
Too scary.
No, I don't think... I think he's grizzly.
Snakes? I'm not scared of snakes.
Yeah. This is gold.
I
reiterate, each time it's gold. But I can just see it. Just when he's stubbly and he's done the whole... When he's done the tank fight or he's done the aeroplane fight, just like a little quip at the end with his inflection as well. I think he can quip.
Someone described his face as an constant upside-down triangle.
Yeah.
I did a face then on a podcast.
Yeah.
So,
and your face looked like an upside-down triangle, yeah. And therefore it looked like Vincent Cassel.
Excellent.
Yeah. So as I said, you've totally robbed me. I don't want to do Cassel as well. So I'll go with my backup, which was Nathalie Bay, who is the matriarch in this film. More like Nathalie Bay. B-A-E. Yeah, thank you. She's great in this. And so I thought in this film, if you haven't seen it, you will know what I'm talking about once you have. And if you already have seen it, Nathalie Bay replacing Angelica Houston in anything.
Oh.
But I was thinking Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
I was thinking more Royal Tenenbaums. I thought you were going to go that route. Because she's another matriarch.
Yeah, she is. But I think I went Zissou because it kind of has that European feel to the film.
Right.
And Tenenbaums is very much a New York film. Whereas Steve Zissou, with what it's about, with the sense of travel and the Jacques Cousteau-ness about it, I can just imagine her on in various different exotic locations, just being this kind of lovely European, queen of everything. Wherever she turns up, she would be that character. And I think there is some sense of that in here, but in the not so fun ways.
In the domesticated form.
Yeah. But I could see her as Houston's role in Zissou.
She'd make a great... If they did a French Everybody Loves Raymond,
She'd
be a great Marie Barone.
She would be. That would be really, really good. And then you could cast Vincent Cassel
as Raymond.
I was going to go Robert.
As Robert, okay.
As Frank. okay, yeah. So There's only two of us. We can't get a good jury on who's won the pitch.
No.
I think let's go Carlisle, because I can't host and then take the points to myself.
You can do what you want.
There we are. I think you get another one. So I think you might be in the lead now.
I think I'm winning now, yeah.
Yeah, you got 2 points. Right, well done, mate.
Thank
you. I look forward to T3 train spotting.
T3.
Lovely. Yeah, they do that kind of thing. We could get a French remake of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. Get Danny Boyle on the phone. I'm sure he's already worked with Cassell in Trance.
Yeah, I forget he's in Trance. Oh, yeah. He has fun in Trance, doesn't he?
Yeah, see?
Yeah, you're right.
He's fun.
He's still scary, though.
Yeah, I think he's always scary.
Yeah. He was supposed to be in Gaspar Noé's Love.
Oh, when it was really, really early conceived.
Yeah, it was him and his wife, Monica Bellucci.
Mm. Right, let's get back to It's Only the End of the World. And so this is Xavier Dolan's new film about a chap called Louis who left home about 12 years ago, hasn't been home since, still keeps in touch, very occasionally rings, sends postcards.
Cryptic postcards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a writer, playwright, and he is returning home because he is telling his family that he has a terminal illness and is dying. And so they've all got together at once to meet him, really. You've got the older brother, the older brother's wife, the younger sister, played by... the older brother is Vincent Cassell.
Yep, Antoine.
Yeah. The younger sister, Léa Seydoux.
Suzanne.
Yeah, who never really knew him. She is very much the younger sister.
This is essentially her first time meeting him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Natalie Bay as the mother.
Unnamed.
Yeah, just La Mère. And so they're all getting together for this. And this is based on a play called Juste la fin du monde. And it's... We talked about this with Fences earlier. A couple of weeks ago. And this feels also... You could see this as a play.
Yeah, I think easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not a bad thing.
No. It's not stagey, but... You know, ensemble cast, one location, that is play.
Yeah. This is it's August Osage County.
Yeah, it's that kind of sort of dysfunctional family vibe, and the audience is sided with essentially the one normal person in the family who is returning home after a long time.
Yeah.
That's almost a trope, I guess, of this kind of thing. You see it quite a lot, and I think August Osage County is a good example. Even something like... His Royal Tenenbaums has a similar kind of feel with big dysfunctional family trying to work through different things. And I'd be interested to see the play, actually.
Yeah. All right. So that's the setup for the film. Let's have a quick chat with Xavier Dolan about it. So this was recorded at London Film Festival last year. In the projection booth of one of our cinemas, part of a new series where we've got a few different interviews recorded with a few different directors that we'll be showcasing. And these are also as videos as well that you'll be able to watch with the film when it comes out on Curzon Home Cinema and on Home Media. So let's just quickly listen to that. And to be clear, I wasn't there in the room at the time, so I've just had to record my questions now and then cut them into the interview. So, Xavier, what made you want to adapt Juste la fin du monde into a film?
I guess the characters were very very flawed somehow, very very, I mean, they were loud and they were very aggressive and very very aggressive, but underneath the layers of verbal violence and the all the horrible things they say to each other, there was a lot of there was a palpable pain, and it really interested me to explore that with actors. I mean, they're not obvious characters; they're not easy to love, but they conceal a lot of many wounds, and that seemed like a beautiful challenge, especially in terms of acting, and I knew it would be very I thought it would be very rewarding to explore these flaws and these imperfections with actors of that category, let's say.
And how is it translating this from the stage to a film?
Yeah, and the so there was one thing we decided that, you know, that it was clear from the very beginning is that I didn't want to lose the vernacular of the playwright is very theatrical, I guess, and very precise, very sophisticated, very can be, you know, scary when you hear it first, but I didn't want to lose that because I think that his legacy and his cultural, you know, yeah, his cultural legacy are these words and that precise style and vernacular, and I didn't want to lose that. So we knew that we would be keeping the language, the style of the play. One thing we couldn't keep with was the second half of the play was almost entirely abstract in its structure and its construction. It's just people on stage talking to you don't know who, and they're all standing on stage and not really talking to each other, and that really didn't that couldn't possibly work cinematically. So we had to invent a second half to the play and take, you know, bits and pieces and just move them around and sort of, you know, play with scenes, you know, that came later on and or scenes that were early in the play, and just sort of build that half from, you know, that latter half from almost from scratch. You know, it was a pretty challenge.
And was it intentional to not show Louis leaving in the first place?
I mean, I know that was apparently that's been frustrating to a lot of people, not knowing, you know, per se what he is dying from or why he left home. But I guess the idea and what we felt with the actors and everything, because a lot of the, you know, the actors also had a lot of questions, and I didn't always have the answers myself. And it's not that we didn't want to look for them, or we didn't want to, you know, make the effort to provide the audience with answers. It's that to us what matters is that afternoon that they spend together and the very little time they have to try to reconnect and talk to each other, which they clearly cannot achieve because they don't really listen. They don't listen. They talk, but they don't, you know, listen to each other. So why did Louis, you know, leave? Is it because, you know, he was just drawn to the city? It seems radical to leave for 12 years, because that's you know, the story, he's been gone for 12 years without ever coming back. So that seems extreme, and you're like, what can motivate, you know, such a selfish act of isolation, and how can you leave behind everything, including all your loved ones, even if, you know, if something terrible happened? And it's actually not the point. The thing is, by the time the movie is over, the questions you had in the beginning, such as why did he leave, should be answered by the fact that these people consume each other and are just, you cannot possibly imagine yourself living with these characters. As much as I find them endearing, they're, you know, they don't know how to love each other, they don't know how to live together. It's clear that someone, you know, who has the sensibility Louis appears to have, well, they're all very sensitive, but anyway, who has the sensibility he appears to have, couldn't live in an environment like that and would want to escape.
Why do you think these family members are constantly clashing?
Well, I guess they're entirely, you know, incapable of listening to each other, and from that incapacity comes the constant misunderstandings and miscommunication. So, it's they're just not able to. I don't know. I don't know how to answer a question. Sorry. It's. I just think some people can't live together and can't, you know. I think we've lived it with various members of our own families. It's. Sometimes you're born in a place with people with whom you have very little in common, and it doesn't mean that they're. That they're bad people, or it just means that you're not meant to live with them and communicate with them, and you just need to escape or you're gonna kill yourself. Not that I would really know what that feels like, because I actually do have a very nice relationship with my family. I mean, we play games, and whether on my mother's side or my father's side, it's just, but it was very appealing and appealing to me, that whole thematic, you know, whole dynamic of miscommunication and incapacity to listen. It's just, we live in a time where we have so many platforms and so many ways of communicating with each other, you know, all the social media and everything, but yet we grow apart and we just drift alone, each on our side. So I don't know. Sorry, it's impossible to answer the question in a coherent way, it seems.
What led you to using close-ups for almost the majority of the film?
When we began shooting, we did, you know, shoot medium shots and establishing shots and large, you know, wide shots. And it was just, they were in the space within which we were shooting. It was hard to frame these wide shots. Very few would be relevant, would be also pretty or aesthetically pleasing, and you know, that was, I guess, the most important reason why we decided to focus on very tight shots, is that when we had that distance with the characters, when we were too wide, it really appeared like we were filming theater on a stage. Like, it really appeared like a I don't know how you call that in English, but anyway, you know when you're watching theater on TV? We have a word for it in French, but I'm not familiar with the word in English. So we wanted to because the dialogue was so theatrical in its own way, we at least wanted to compensate with being very close to the characters, so that at least we could provide the audience with a certain sense of what is going on underneath all the layers of dialogue, all that loquacious, you know, dialogue. It was important to, because of the prolixity of the characters, it was important to provide the audience with a sense of intimacy, I guess, and just show them the eyes and all the subtleties that seem to be going on the faces of the actors, which is in the end what matters, because none of that, you know, none of those words or dialogue actually matters. It's what matters is what happens within, you know, in the their silences and their you know, their smiles and how they breathe and look at each other. That's where everything happened. That's where the money was.
And what interests you about experimenting with your work?
Well, I don't know. I guess the sense of discovery and I mean, the word exploration, when you say explore, seems you know, daunting and challenging in itself. I guess that's the whole answer is right there. It's, I don't want to stagnate in the same ideas and because I've been talking about the same sort of dynamics and the same, not telling the same story over and over again, but I guess that's what I've been doing. So, with different characters and different, so you know, coming from different social strata and with different issues and different backgrounds, different pasts, sometimes in different times, but they do have the same identity problems. They're looking for themselves. They're looking for a place in society. They are misfits. They're trying to fit in. They often love someone who doesn't love them back. It's often the same problems and the same themes. So one of the many ways to feel that you're not stagnating, I guess, is to explore things formally. So it's always interesting to me to explore new formats or new ratios, new. I mean, these are subtle, you know, the subtle choices. Sometimes they're not very apparent apparent to some people. But you know, if you choose to shoot old close-ups and you know with a 35mm this close to someone's face, it's an entirely different aesthetic than if you put a 50 or an 80 from you know further away. It's these little choices that correspond to the story you're telling, and you try to instinctively make decisions and say, well, I think this is what this film needs and what this story needs.
And your work up until now tends to feature a matriarchal figure. What do you think draws you to that?
I mean, it depends. That's the, you know, the mother in the play is, this is the way she is. Strong woman, which I assume is a figure that I come back to for some reason. But you know, Natalie Bai was a mom in Lawrence anyways, and she was diametrically opposed to who the character she's playing in this film. Comes and goes, I guess. It's some characters are stronger and some others are, you know, not as strong, I guess. In Mommy you have the girl next door, the girl across the street actually, who's a mother as well, but who's a very strong character as well, but in a different way, in a less expressive, less Latin way than Di. So as far as I'm concerned, all characters in It's Only the End of the World are as strongly tempered as Martine is. But yeah, mother figures are, I don't know. I see them as strong. Although I don't think of Diane and Martine as comparable in any way, in terms of age, in terms of behavior, in terms of tastes, in terms of background. They're completely different women, and. Comparisons have been, you know, a lot of people have compared them, and it's just, I understand, but it's just, you know, one dresses as a teen and the other is, you know, that there's a, of course, an age gap between them both, and they're just, they have different issues, they have different lives, they live with different means, they come from a different background. You know, not all strong women are the same women. Woman. Sorry.
All right, so there we go. So, It's Only the End of the World. What do we think?
Very, very good. I think we said earlier how adapting plays, you often can tell when things are based on a play. And I think for some films that doesn't always work. So for something like Roland Polanski's film Carnage, for me that didn't work. It really felt like it was just filming a play rather than a film. And this, I think, avoids that. I think and even the plot of this film is very uncinematic. Mm. As we said earlier, it's just a guy going home to his family. But I think Dolan, he uses, so you've got these close-ups all the way through. And I think nearly every shot of a person is close-up. And that just makes it feel so sort of claustrophobic.
Yep.
And that's what you don't get in a play.
Yeah.
That feeling of claustrophobia.
Yeah, and that's why I loved watching this in the cinema as well.
Yeah.
We saw this on a huge screen at the London Film Festival, and seeing those ginormous faces just towering over you, you do, as you say, get that great sense of claustrophobia, which really works in a cinema screen. I've seen it twice now, actually, second time, also cinema environment. And just great for just towering over you and capturing you within this space. And Louis has this feeling throughout that he's halfway between, he's like in this limbo state, in that he wants to be leaving but has this guilt and need to stay as well. And when these faces fill the screen, you really get that sense from him.
Yeah, and they're not just in front of you. They're often screaming at you or shouting at you or telling you how disappointed they are in you or how much they love you or this and that. Or, I mean, with Marion Cotillard, she has her performance is very small.
Mm.
Like, she's very shy and sort of timid. But even when she's up against you, you really feel she's really in your face and she's really sort of pressuring you to give her some sort of reaction.
Yeah.
And I think what works really well with this whole technique is that Gaspard Ulliel, who plays Louis, he's so reserved in this film.
Yeah.
To the point where we don't really know anything about him.
Yeah, he's got he's a blank canvas.
Yeah, and that works for us.
Mm.
So we can it's easy. It's like The Revenant, I guess, where the less you know about the lead character and that protagonist, the easier it is for you to sort of fuse yourself with him so that you can really feel the sort of... obviously, he's ill, first of all, but also he really doesn't want to be there.
Yeah,
I think, and neither do you.
There is although it's very gallows humour. There is a nice joke running throughout that he's clearly looks very ill, and they keep telling him how good he looks, which is a nice little break throughout. Although it's quite dark. So let's start at the beginning with this thing, and we've got Louis on the plane going home, and then he gets in a cab, and then this cab sequence, I love this cab sequence, because you've got this I'm awful here and I've forgotten the name of the song, but there's this really great, very rhythmic track that's made up of like percussion using voices like like those kind of sounds. And that becomes the percussion in this song. It's just a pop song. And that gives you this opening kind of 3.5-4 minutes sequence. And the beat that it's cut together, it's just a music video in itself. It's so, so good. And I could watch that forever, and I've been listening to this song over and over again. And that kind of then flows into the film. The fact that these voices become the rhythm and become the song. And that's where it turns into, because unfortunately, I think because this film has to be subtitled for us because we're not clever enough, I think maybe something gets lost there, because hearing those voices overlap in the same way that we love hearing something like a David Mamet play, where it's not just about the words that are being said.
It's how they say it, and the sort of people are answering questions that were asked a few lines back.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
And they bounce and collide these sentences, and I wish I could understand it to hear it in that form.
Yeah,
because I think
the poetry of it.
Because I don't think that song at the beginning is unintentional.
Right.
And I think that's very much part of the film, and those are the bits that you couldn't do on stage, and those are the bits that Dolan is getting in there. There are a few kind of flashback bits as well, which you could never do.
Yeah,
and that runs throughout the film. And we've already mentioned Danny Boyle today. I think with this closed setting type film, which Danny Boyle can be very good with, expanding a very small space to feel huge. If you think of Slumdog Millionaire, it's essentially just the set of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Well, it's Shallow Grave.
Shallow
predominantly
Grave.
All set in one house.
Yeah, 127 hours. Yeah. But they become such big things. And that's a little bit of what we get with this house, that Dolan expands the stage a bit, but never gratuitously, like something like 127 hours.
Yeah.
And you get these little flashes of memory, which I think always happens when you go to a family home at Christmas that you haven't been to or something.
Yeah.
And you might get a smell or a book or a sound.
Yeah, there was a bit that really rung true for me when he washes his hands and he smells the soap and sort of smiles. And I remember whenever I go home, and if I wash my hands, I don't think about it, and I just smell the soap and think, oh yeah, that's the soap that's always here.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. And smell is the sense that is most linked to memory.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so he's in this cab and he's on his way home and he's kind of readjusting to this. It's quite a rural area. It's not a farm.
We're told it's somewhere.
Yeah.
There's never given a location.
Yeah. And we get the impression that he's coming from quite a cool place.
I think so. I think because he's a playwright, isn't he? So you get this impression that the family are slightly resentful of the fact, excuse me, that he has made it.
Mm.
He's successful, and that during the height of his success, he didn't really give them the time of day.
Yep.
And I think you can get that. But the way he dresses, the way he acts, he's from a more urban area.
Yeah.
But coming back from the city to the more rural family home. And you can even tell that in, like, cause I think Vincent Cassell's job in this film is
the contrast to that.
Yeah, and he's like a blue collar.
Yeah, he's
worker.
A carpenter. Yeah, yeah. And he makes tools. So not only is a carpenter, he's making the thing that makes the things. He's a super carpenter.
Yeah.
And so he's come back, and then cut in with this lovely rhythm at the start is making snacks. Like chopping carrots and celery sticks and putting hummus in a bowl, and it all becomes part of this chaos. But that, I think that is true of family gatherings, where I'm sure you've had it with your mum or dad or something, where people are coming.
I need to do something.
Yeah.
Something has to change.
Yeah. And someone's doing their nails and they're not quite dry, and someone's still drying their hair, but someone needs to chop the carrots and someone needs to get crisps and put them in a bowl. And in reality, everyone knows that no one really cares and they'd be quite happily getting crisps out of a bag.
Yeah.
But that's all part of this. And I think that just drops you right into it and immediately gets you to relate to this, because we've all been in those horrible, frenetic family dinners. And so then he gets here and we've got this lovely opening scene of them all together just greeting at the front door. And again, something that we all know, where you arrive somewhere and the conversation begins immediately, and that whole conversation happens in the front door and the door is wide open as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice and awkward as well. I guess the first major one we have is Marion Cotillard, because she's the one he has the first sort of moment with.
Yeah.
Because throughout the film, he has these... So while the family's all together and it's kind of awkward and you can tell, you know, nothing really meaningful is happening, I guess one by one, he eventually has these little meaningful moments with them. And the first one was with Marion Cotillard, who plays Catherine. And it's a role that I haven't really seen her do before. Because usually she's plays like confidence really well, and these big characters. Whereas here she's very small, and she's almost sort of Olivia Colman-esque in this performance.
Yes. Although I'm watching Fleabag at the moment, so it's not currently an Olivia Colman. But I definitely see what you mean. And the Marion Cotillard, initially, or when I've watched this film, I've immediately thought Marion Cotillard, she's the best thing in it.
Right,
but I'm beginning to think, am I thinking she's the best thing in it because she is the most delicate and she's the most restrained?
Yeah.
And when we see roles like that, we immediately think, oh, nuance, character, you know. But I think it's just because perhaps she's not loud like the others, and she's not brash, and she's not abrasive. And it is weird that she is the first person that's at the door, because they've never met.
Yeah. Yeah, very weird. And they have this really horrible, uncomfortable interaction when they're all in the living room, and she's trying to explain the reason her son's called Louis, to Louis, and Vincent Cassell, who is her husband and the father, is just He just makes this a really horrible conversation.
Yeah, and he makes her feel like she's really boring.
Yeah.
And just keeps putting her down the whole film through. And it is because Cassell is... He is so annoyed. He is so frustrated that Louis left and that he has made it and that he has a fun job.
Yeah.
He's not working with his hands.
He's a bully, essentially, Vince Cassell,
in
this film.
He's a huge bully, yeah.
And what the film doesn't shy away from that.
Mm.
It doesn't really redeem him,
mm.
which I think a lot of other films would.
I don't think by the end of the film...
He's not a villain,
that's it.
But he's still... It doesn't shy away. He's not like... he's not redeemed, I don't think, entirely.
Yeah. Because there is a really brilliant scene in a car.
Yeah.
In the penultimate scene in the car with Cassell and Louis. And Cassell just tears him apart.
Yeah.
But he tears down this idea of what Louis thinks he is and what Louis thinks he's doing by coming back. And it's savage, but there is a lot of truth in it as well.
Yeah.
Because... Arguably, Louis is himself not entirely good.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the great things about this film is that these characters aren't just what they appear to be. He's not just the bully. Natalie Bay is not just the fussy mum. Léa Seydoux is not just a moody teenager.
Yeah.
Speaking of Léa Seydoux, I thought she was really excellent as well.
Yeah.
Even though she seemed
too old. Yeah.
To be that character,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, I think maybe they just about get away with it, but I think that's slight miscasting, even though she's good.
Mm. I think it's just
convincing, but it is slightly jarring at times.
Dolan is in a point at the moment where he can say that he's doing a film, and all the actors in the world will put their hand up.
I'll do that. Yeah.
And if you're making a film with a French family and French heavyweights can all say, "Yeah, I'll do that," you're going to say yes anyway.
If you can put Léa Seydoux in your film,
you put Léa Seydoux in your film,
despite the fact that she may be about. Like 5 or 10 years too old.
Yeah. Talking about bad teenagers, I love her as the bad teenager purely for her aesthetic and musical choices, because I feel like the music in this film is Xavier Dolan's iPod from 2004.
Everyone's iPod from 2004.
Yeah. But he's not ashamed.
No.
And we shouldn't be ashamed, because I Miss You by Blink-182 is so grating. And when I heard those violin kick in, I suddenly, as we talked about this kind of sensory memory relationship,
yeah.
I hear that and I am so transported back in time by those few little notes. And just hearing that, my face lit up and I was almost not listening to the dialogue because I'm so entranced by Blink-182. But then also the Numa Numa song.
Yes.
Which comes in later.
And there's a dance sequence to that.
Yeah.
Which...
Oh, and it's a joy because it's a memory of a picnic cut to the Numa Numa song. And you think, oh, that song's just trash. That's awful. But in a way, it was like, you know, Iron Man 3 opened with Blue Dabba Dee.
Yeah.
You think, oh, what are they doing? But then suddenly, actually, it's
bold.
Yeah.
Really bold.
Yeah. And actually, you think, this song's not awful, but it was just... Like, it's overplayed and it's hammy,
yeah.
But you put it with the right visuals and it still has value.
It will work, yeah.
And I was not expecting to feel so connected to a sequence whilst they were playing the Numa Numa song. And, yeah, I love that. And there's a Moby song at the end,
yeah,
which I hope was a little nod to, the Bourne Identity in some way. They all ended with Extreme Ways.
Yeah.
And I think this one ends with Natural Blues. But... off of the same Moby album Play, so I think it is I'd like to think it's a little
again not. The soundtrack is something that elevates it from just being a filmed play.
Yeah, I really love this soundtrack, and I know Helen, who normally does the show, who sadly couldn't make it today, just hated the soundtrack. But I think the soundtrack has to be viewed ironically.
I absolutely,
yeah,
it's nostalgic. It's just I picked up my old iPod when I went home the other day, and I was, what was I thinking with some of this?
Why do I have the Numa Numa song 100 times? Right, so, yeah, the music in this is really something that sold it for me. I loved it. Right, so who we need to mention Natalie Bay.
Natalie Bay, yeah, as La Mer. I think she's the character that I've really felt the most sorry for. Because I think she's really trying with all of them.
Yeah,
she's trying to still be a mother to all of them. She's trying to sort of remind them that they were once a happier family.
Yeah,
and no one else cares really. I mean, she has sort of these rich, really nice relationship with Suzanne. But even that feels slightly strained because Suzanne's
just her taxi driver.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, she's the one that just doesn't get why no one is getting along.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And yeah, I just felt really sorry for her.
Yeah, and because these people are all strangers now, and she doesn't quite get that. Because, yeah. I mean, she's given birth to them. She's seen them all live in the house together at points. But they haven't really ever had that.
Yeah, and she's fussing around, make sure everyone's happy, make sure the food's nice. And you think, oh, you're sort of playing to an empty audience here.
Yeah.
It's quite sad to watch.
Yeah. There are a number of scenes that I think are quite key, that each character gets its scene, and you, as the film is playing out, after the first two, you kind of feel, oh, this is how it's going to work. So each person has their scene with Louis, and Louis is the blank canvas, and they project themselves onto him. And so we've got La Mer, the lovely scene in the shed.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful scene, actually.
She's smoking, and she doesn't want anyone to know, but obviously everyone knows anyway, so it doesn't matter. And you've got the one with Cassel in the car. You've got Lea Seydoux in her bedroom, and she's got these sleeve tattoos and posters that just any teenager would be proud to have on their wall. And then maybe my favourite scene from the whole film is where Louis is in the bathroom and bumps into Marion Cotillard just outside. And there is... you get the sense through the film that she is the only one, the stranger of this family, the one person that shouldn't know him. She knows exactly why he's there.
Yeah, she seems... yeah, I definitely think that we're supposed to get that feeling from her.
Yeah,
that she understands, but no one else can. But because she's too shy, she won't tell anyone about him and try and get them to understand.
Yeah, and it's this just working. Even though you may think once you figured it out that the structure will get tired, it doesn't really, because you... it's kind of broken up by the family dinner in between.
Yeah,
it's not like a conveyor belt of conversations.
Yeah, and when you do have these big conversations with all of them, they are like sort of ping pong matches.
Yeah.
They're like just firing things back at each other at a really fast pace, like you said, sort of mammoth-esque in terms of some of the dialogue.
But weirdly, something that it made me think of, I don't know how you feel about this, but J.B. Priestley's in Inspector Calls. Do you know? Oh, so this was... I think this is just because I did it in school, and so it's just a kind of rich family.
Right.
And one of them, or the dad of the family, owns I think it's a workhouse or a mill or something. And one worker at the mill, I think she's a worker, she ends up dead outside. Right. And an inspector comes to the house and basically works through every member of the family to see how... he's not there to figure out who did it. He's there to basically tell them, you all did it.
Right, okay.
That you've all done something bad. And I think as you work your way through this film, through those conversations, I see why you are in the state that you're in, but I also see why Louis is gone.
Yeah.
Like, what led him to leave? You can see that in all of these people.
Yeah, I can see that comparison easily. Yeah.
Right. I think we may have to wrap up soon. So let's do a quick spoiler section. I don't think there's too much that we need to go into.
No, just one little bit, I think.
All right. So we'll just so pause it there and go and check out the film. It is on Curzon Home Cinema from today. So go and watch it straight away. You've got no reason not to, even if it's not in the cinema. But if you do have a cinema playing it, go and check it out for those big faces. They're lovely. Right. So give it a pause and come back to us for a minute or two of spoilers.
So I think the biggest spoiler is that he doesn't tell them he's dying.
Yeah.
Which I think I could see that coming.
Yes.
I think it's fairly obvious because as much as Dolan, I think, loves unapologetic melodrama.
Which this is.
I think even that is too far for him.
Yeah.
To have the moment where he tells them he's dying.
Yeah.
I think that would have been quite bad, in fact, if you had that scene.
Yeah.
It just would not have felt right at the end of this film.
Yep. I could see it as the kind of crying Oscar moment in Wayne's World. And I never learned to read. Yeah. I could see it being that.
And once you've got to know Louis throughout the whole film, I just think you know that this is not something he kind of psychs himself up to do it. And I think that you know him as little as we know about him. It just doesn't fit his character that he actually would tell them he's dying.
Yeah.
After this horrible day.
And I think that they are all better off not knowing as well.
The film's got quite a pessimistic view of family, I think.
Yeah.
As much as it's kind of, there are nice moments, ultimately the film is kind of like you can't solve all your problems by talking about them.
Yeah.
Because he's dying no matter what, and he doesn't get on with his family no matter what. So what's the point of combining those two things and making an even bigger problem for himself?
Yeah.
And yet we said there are like these nice little moments with each individual member of the family, but there's no resolution to any of it.
Yeah.
There's no this feeling we're going to be a bigger, happy family after this. It's quite cynical in a way, and quite pessimistic.
And I would just add as a last point, so I took my dad to watch this film. He was a man who worked, he's still going. He worked in the field of terminal illness for 20 odd years, hospices, hospitals, that kind of thing. And so I thought it'd be really interesting to take him to this film. And afterwards, I said, we were talking about it. I was like, it's very over the top, though, isn't it? It's very melodramatic. And he said, no, actually, to be honest, there is no more or no less than reality, which I was quite amazed by. And so that really shifted my opinion on this film, that as someone that would have been sat right in the middle of these conversations, that this is actually accurate.
Okay, so as promised, it's now time for our Berlin Film Festival Roundup. This is with me, Damo, and Kate. Okay, so we're now joined by Kate Garova, who is the head of marketing for Curzon, and Damien Spandley, the director of programming. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
So, how was the Berlin Film Festival this year?
It was great. I mean, people always complain about the commerce of a market because there's a festival which is curated by programmers, and then there's the European film market, which is, you know, people buying and selling films for overseas territories. And there's always sort of like usually two opinions that are running throughout a market festival. I think people in general were quite disappointed with the commercial side.
Right.
But from the sort of curated programming side, Berlin is a great festival, especially if you love art house cinema.
It was really cold. It was really like Siberian cold, I would say. This year?
Yeah, it was.
Which obviously necessitated schnapps at regular intervals for... but I agree with Damo that it is... I think it's almost like an avant-garde festival, or at least the most avant-garde festival that I go to in the year. And you see things there that you know will turn up in other festivals. And it's about discovery and people taking risks with filmmaking, and it's not always successful, and it can be very varied, but it's the thing that reminds you why you sort of fell in love with films in the first place, because it's such a great selection of stuff to see.
Okay, so Berlin's kind of the starting point for a lot of films then in the festival run, would you say?
Well, a lot of festivals, they'll want international, i.e. global premieres, and Berlin definitely has that status. So I think we will see some of these films that will reappear, for example, in London later on in October. And obviously some of the films will be picked up, acquired by distributors, so we'll definitely see them on release.
Okay.
Yeah, it's probably one of the sort of four key festivals in the international calendar. And I mean, there was one particular film that I really enjoyed, which wasn't in competition, and I later found out it's because it had played Sundance. Right. So there is this kind of competition between the festivals to get that world premiere.
All right, so before we get into then, I suppose the other things you like, should we talk about the big awards that were handed out this year? So start with Golden Bear.
Yeah,
so that's on Body and Soul, which was a Hungarian movie that I really enjoyed, probably because I'm an OCD romantic, and that's what it is. It's a film for OCD romantics. It's not an easy film, you know, it's a difficult movie. It's set in an abattoir in Budapest, and it's about a very unusual love story between the boss of the abattoir and a very OCD and very exacting meat inspector. And basically they find out accidentally that they are having the same dream every evening. They're dreaming that they are deer running through the forest together,
which happens to a lot of us.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, this happens to me and Kate all the time, and but we don't talk about it around the office
usually.
So it's a really beautiful idea, and the film is shot with the same sort of precision as the sort of like lead female character. Lots of very sort of cinescope photography, lots of sharp lines, lots of really sort of muted greens and greys, and it's difficult to watch at times. There's some quite bloody scenes of cows being slaughtered. The woman next to me in the screen I was in was freaking out, but definitely the director, Ildiko Enyedi, is one to watch, definitely a voice for the future, and I hope it does get picked up for the UK.
Okay, excellent. So no release date for that yet?
No, nothing. We haven't heard anything about that yet.
Okay, and then so the Silver Bear Grand Jury Prize went to Félicité?
Yes, it did indeed, yeah, which is a film that actually split our team. I actually really enjoyed it. I would say it's I, Daniel Blake, Congolese style. You know, it's just, I know it's a bit glib, but it's got a fantastic opening scene of sort of all handheld photography and introducing all the characters in a nightclub while the lead character is singing. Yeah. She's a singer, but then it very quickly gets down to business, and she has her son has been in a motorbike accident, and the local hospital won't operate until she's paid the money for the operation. Right. So while his condition is deteriorating, she's out on the streets by trying whatever she can to get the money together. It's really powerful. For me, it lost its way a little bit sort of in the third act, but it had a strong ending. And I'm happy that it won something. I think it's very important for some of the smaller films from less-known directors. Mm-hmm. These awards can give them profile. And actually, when I saw On Body and Soul, for instance, I was wondering how you would frame that release in the UK without the profile of a cast or well-known director, and good for them that they picked up the Golden Bear.
Excellent. Kate, so any highlights?
One we could talk about is a Panorama winner, which is another part of the festival, and the Audience Award winner was for a film called Insyriated. I didn't realise that I was going to say it with two syllables until I spoke out loud.
It's really difficult to say. Insyriated. Anyway.
I think it means under, not under siege, but something along those lines. Yeah. And it's actually set in a flat in Damascus. So it's by a Belgian filmmaker, and I'm pretty sure that it will be coming to UK cinemas.
Yeah, it won a couple of awards, didn't it, I think?
Did it?
Yeah, I think so.
And the premise is a family that have refused to leave the flat. So it's a woman and her children and her father-in-law, and they haven't left the flat, and then there are some other people who have moved in as well. And so and it's all set in basically in the apartment, so it's kind of quite taut, quite claustrophobic. You have the sense of this sort of life, which just from morning to night is just about these kind of small punctuations of trying to move time on, but under this terrible sort of regime that you can't leave. There's a sniper who's operating, so if any of them leave the flat, there's a very highly likely chance that they'll be shot. And at the same time, there's people who come who clearly, you know, are either burglars or worse, who pretend to be, you know, that pretend that they're coming, you know, as part of a kind of a proper, that they're coming to see if they're all right. And so it's very kind of taut.
Yeah, it's kind of a film that's about how people sort of lose their moral decency when they're in this situation, you know, when like martial law or chaos on the streets. And it's incredibly very powerful, packs a huge punch.
Okay, excellent. That sounds really good. And then there's a documentary that I think a lot of people have been talking about, which is I Am Not Your Negro.
Yeah, that's right. So it's directed by a very talented Haitian director called Raoul Peck. He actually had two films out in Berlin, which is pretty impressive, although Army Hammer had about 12.
Yes, he did. Star of Berlin.
And yeah, he also directed a drama called Young Karl Marx, which was one of the competition, I think. But I Am Not Your Negro is being released by Altitude, who are the distribution company behind Amy.
Yeah.
It's out in the UK on the 7th of April, and it's terrific. Yeah, it's an authored documentary. So what I mean by that is it's not necessarily about recording something that happened. I mean, it's about the civil rights situation in the US in the 50s and 60s. And although it's sort of centered around some of the key commentators of the time, like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, it's told from the perspective of a writer and commentator of the day, who I didn't know anything about, actually, James Baldwin, who's an unbelievably magnetic speaker. And he left the US and was in Paris, living the sort of life of sort of like intellectual, and was compelled to return back to the US when he saw what was happening, and was an important voice of that time. And the sort of starting point of the documentary is his prose, which Samuel L. Jackson narrates throughout the film, and just some terrific sort of archive footage, some very harrowing archive footage, but also the footage of him actually speaking and doing chat shows, you know, just sort of fall in love with him. So that's one for audiences to look out for in a month or two.
April.
7th of April.
Yeah, okay. And was that eligible for Best Documentary?
Yes, in fact it won. Thank you for the prompt, Sam. Yes, it won the Panorama Documentary Award. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Okay, great. Well, other highlights of the festival this year?
Well, one of my favourite films was A Fantastic Woman, which was I won a Silver Bear for Best
Screenplay.
And it also won the Teddy Award as well. And it's a film by Sebastian Lelio, who directed Gloria, which it's my absolute shame I haven't seen, but I know from contemporaries that it's a terrific movie. He is very much on the rise. I mean, looking like that, you know, he could be potentially the next Pablo Larraín. It's a Chilean movie about a central character is a transgender woman played by Daniela Vega, I think, is that correct? And it's the story, so she is effectively living a normal life in a relationship with a middle-aged man. They share a flat and a dog, and then he unexpectedly dies. Right. And she is left instead of being left to grieve, she's sort of put into a system where the family show prejudice towards her. They never accepted her presence in her boyfriend's life. and she's under suspicion from the police. You know, they suspect foul play surrounding his death, and it's just such an amazing, powerful performance. But the film is also shot in extremely sort of very, very stylish way. I mean, the reviews are terrific. It already has a 5-star review in The Guardian. And I mean, for me, it reminded me a little bit of Brian De Palma's melodramas of the 70s, but it right. isn't trashy. I have to emphasize yeah. that. It's actually a very strong, sort of grounded film. It's also been compared very favorably to Pedro and very fairly to Pedro Almodovar as well.
I think it's very Almodovar-esque. It's really beautiful. So one of the things about the Berlinale this year is I think the filmmakers seemed very sort of politicized. There were a lot of comments. Yeah. I mean, I think we'll see this a lot on the red carpet this year, people using kind of platforms right. to, you know, to sort of talk about the sort of global times that we live yeah. in. So Sebastian Lelio, when he accepted the award for the screenplay, said we have to fight the dark ages with beauty, with elegance and poetry, and I think that perfectly sums wow. up the film, because that's, you know, what it is. It's really yeah. dreamy, has a great breakout dance sequence. It's a must see, I have yeah. to say.
Excellent. Okay, I look forward to that one. And then I'm looking at, so best director went to Aki Kaurismäki, who's returned to the forefront with The Other Side of Hope.
Yes, it's a great return, actually. And I mean, Aki Kaurismäki, you know, Finnish director, he's been around for many years, since the sort of Leningrad cowboy days, and has just released, you know, some terrific movies. Very, very distinct voice, very, very sort of individual language of cinema. And yeah, I'd say return to form. He's never been off form. But yeah, I mean, that's out. I mean, we're very proud that that's actually a Curzon Artificial Eye release in the UK and is going out on the 26th of May. And he picked up Best Director. In the screening I went in, it's very odd, but I've actually sort of realised after years of watching him that he's a feel-good director, which is a surprising thing to say, because yeah. his films are very dry, and they're set in this sort of like 1980s sort of like miserable sort of, miserable world, but actually the humour comes through and actually cheers you up while you're watching the film. So it's actually a very accessible watch. And this is probably his warmest film ever. I mean, he's taken on immigration, which is very, obviously very topical. Not necessarily, you know, I've never really considered him a political director before. But actually, there's some real moments of genuine moments of warmth throughout the film. And so it's both funny and warm, as well as obviously being a little bit miserable as well, which is, of course, essential. Element, and yeah, I mean, that's going to be 5-star reviews on release, and one of the best films of the year.
And again, in his press conference, he spoke about needing humanity, and obviously needing yeah. it, you know, now more than ever. What are we without that? What are we if we can't show our kind of, you know, humanity and our friendship to our neighbours? And so again, you know, filmmakers accepting awards or talking in these very kind of public spaces yeah. as real mirrors to the films that they've produced.
Okay, wonderful. Any other highlights for you guys?
Well, we had another film that was playing at the festival called Berlin Syndrome, which yeah. is out and released on the 9th of June, which definitely deserves a mention. It's a Kate Shortland film, and she's the Australian director who burst onto the scene and launched Abby Cornish's career with Somersault. And she also had a hit with Law. And this is a Berlin-set thriller starring Teresa Palmer. And yeah, it's great. It's like her sort of like doing a more genre style movie. And yeah, Teresa Palmer plays a young independent woman who's in Berlin photographing the city, who falls for and sleeps with a local teacher who also, unfortunately for her, happens to be a serial obsessive kidnapper, and she finds herself prisoned in his apartment. So it's real, you know, a bit of a departure for her. But I think, I mean, certainly for the people who flocked to see Victoria, because some obvious comparisons, yeah, parallels between the two films, it's one that that they'll enjoy on release.
It's very tense. Yeah. It's not the sort of film that I would want to watch whilst I was in Berlin. It would feel a bit too close to home. Yeah. But
Get out of Berlin.
Get out of Berlin. Yeah, don't talk to strangers. Yeah. Never has there been, a film. But talking, I think we should do something special around Armie Hammer, because I feel like I've seen a lot of Armie Hammer.
You mean that in more ways than one, don't you?
I really feel that. Yeah, I really do. Yeah. And I wasn't expecting it. I really wasn't anticipating that. But I read something about him that says that, you know, he's sort of almost damned by his good movie looks, and yet he's actually turning out to be a great character actor.
I always think it's interesting when you have stars like Armie Hammer and you think about the choices that they make in their professional life, and he's making some really interesting choices.
He is, yes.
So like sort of Kristen Stewart, who's now become sort of a doyenne of sort of art house or auteur cinema. Armie Hammer's doing something a bit similar, and he was in at least two, maybe three movies, I think, in Berlin.
I think he's in two movies, but he's also in Free Fire, which is coming out next month. Yes, so I feel like
true.
I'm seeing.
That's true. So he was in Stanley Tucci's Final Portrait, which was a study of the artist Alberto Giacometti. But the film that really, well, I thought was just terrific was Call Me by Your Name, which is the latest film from Italian director Luca Guadagnino. Who's the director of I Am Love and The Biggest Splash, and it's such a brave performance from him. I mean, he's playing, this is a gay romance set in 1980s northern Italian Lakeland, and it's about a visiting American who's staying with some academics in the countryside, and an attraction grows between him and the 17-year-old son of his host. And it's just such a, I mean, Sony have it, so we know it's going to be released, I think, in the summer here in the UK. 5-star review in The Guardian. And this is the film, actually, I mentioned before, that didn't make competition because it was in Sundance, which is a shame, because it would have powered through the awards, I'm sure. And it's just such a, I mean, the film's a slow build. It's you get to enjoy the sort of scenery and, you know, soak in the sun and get to understand the characters. And then slowly the sort of gay story starts to emerge. And it's really beautifully played and just such a touching film.
It's a love affair. I mean, it's you know, it's a sort of rites of passage for the 17-year-old. It's the first time that he's, you know, that we see that he's feeling, you know, these very strong emotions. And I think that it's not even anything to do with, you know, about him necessarily being gay. It's just more that he's falling in love, and, you know, there's nothing creepy about it, because on paper, you know, an older visiting, even if he looks like Armie Hammer, in a 17-year-old, you know, but it's not like that at all. It is just beautifully captured. There is something really beautiful about their love affair and the sort of acceptance of it. It's great. I thought it was really sublime.
Okay, I remember, because that was the one to take away from Sundance, I remember, this year as well. That was the film on everyone's lips, and I guess it's the same with Berlin as well. It's one of the big talking points.
Yeah, definitely. So it was... By the time I got to see it, which I think was on the day that I left, it was definitely the ticket that you had to have. So sometimes that happens in festivals, and there may have been more films after that. But yeah.
I remember in London, I saw Nocturnal Animals, Birth of a Nation, and Three Fire all on the same day, all with Armie Hammer. He's everywhere.
He is everywhere.
He's unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean,
he's busy. He is really busy.
I mean, there's also a film called Mine, which I don't think has been released in the UK, but it's coming out soon in the US, which is another independent movie. I mean, he really is working hard.
Yeah, it's good to see though that he can do things like The Lone Ranger, and then come back and do, like, we've mentioned like 6 or 7 films that he's in this year, which are all
really smart, indie,
art house fairs.
Yeah,
it's really great. Speaking of art house affairs, Logan,
Yeah, so that was my guilty pleasure of the festival, because it was playing out of competition, and I snuck away to see it, and I'm really glad I did, actually, because I'm not really an X-Man, X-Men fan. No, not. I mean, I'm not an X-Man, obviously, but I'm not really so much an X-Man fan
either.
Have
you ever thought what your meta power would be?
Oh, that's a good... Yeah, I'm not sure. Would it be? I don't know. I guess... I don't know. I think maybe to see the commercial potential of films, that would be quite handy to have in my role. What's really interesting about it is that it's the closest you'll get from the X-Men canon to a drama. And I mean, it's directed by James Mangold, who's already directed Wolverine, and so he's obviously fascinated with that particular character. And it's set, I mean, certainly for the first half of the movie, it very much is a drama that explores the different characters, it's set beyond the Mexican border, and it's set slightly in the future. It's 25 years since there's been a mutant birth on Earth, and the mutants are considered to be over and done with. Logan is sort of washed up and alcoholic, sort of living in the middle of nowhere, and then the appearance of this young girl who appears to have been certainly has some of his X-Men characteristics turns up, and all of a sudden the authorities are onto him and he's been exposed. But I definitely, I haven't seen even the last one or two, but I would certainly recommend this one because, Patrick Stewart is terrific in it. You get to see him properly act, which I'm not sure he's really done in any of the previous X-Men films. And it just has this, it's just sort of terrific sort of story that isn't necessarily just about the explosions and the action. Although, don't worry, that's in there. They get to it eventually. What I thought was quite interesting watching it was that sort of tension between actually a proper drama that isn't about superheroes and this actual superhero film, and how the film actually manages to straddle both.
Okay, it's great that you can have a fantastic woman and Logan playing at the same festival. So,
absolutely.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah, some people are a bit snotty sometimes about the out of competition. Sometimes they feel it's abused because it is. I mean, let's face it, it's an excuse to bring in the Hollywood movies or a bit of glamour to a festival. But most people who like movies, or the right people who like movies, like a whole range of stuff. So why shouldn't you? Why shouldn't you watch a big commercial movie one day and then a Romanian miserablest drama the next?
Excellent.
I agree. And also I think Berlin certainly claims to be the festival with the largest public the most public go to the festival. I think that's great. I think, we should have this, they should have this sort of diverse range of films.
Kate, any recommendations for us?
I didn't really have any guilty pleasures apart from the aforementioned Schnapps. There's one film that I just wanted to talk about because I thought that it was very interesting narratively, and it's a film called Casting Jean Benet. And if you are as old as I am, you may remember about 20 years ago there was a murder of a six-year-old beauty pageant girl called Jean Benet Ramsey, she was found dead in her parents' house in the basement, and obviously her parents were at the time accused of being responsible, though they denied it. There was no they weren't charged, and subsequently they wrote a book about it, and this documentary is about it's called Casting Jean Benet, and the premise is that the director has gone back and asked residents who lived at the time in this town called Boulder to to act as the Ramses, as though she's going to make a feature film, basically. So it's all people who remember the crime happening. So they're auditioning to play the parents. There's a child auditioning to play the brother, for example. And then as she's talking to them, and it's a talking head scenario, they start to also talk about that time, what they remember about that time, and what they remember about the Ramses. And, you know, in it, they sort of talk about their own, you know, issues that they might have as well. And it makes for a really interesting documentary narrative. There are no sort of, there's no footage from that time, so there's no news footage, nothing like that. So it's an entirely kind of reconstructed, and it just sort of bridges this gap between, you know, sort of fiction and fact. And if you saw Kate Plays Christine last year, and I think that kind of, you know, sort of played around with a sort of documentary narrative.
Sure.
So I just wonder if we'll see a lot more kind of documentaries like this. It got, again, a 5-star review in The Guardian out of Sundance.
Okay, that's kind of in the same sort of vein as My Scientology Movie as well.
Sure,
Playing around with recreation and sort of looking at recreation as well.
Yeah.
I guess that's what documentary does best now, doesn't it? Sort of play around with its own form.
Yeah, I think it moves on. It's not a simple retelling. Yeah. You know, it's this idea of a sort of reinterpretation and these people's stories. It does feel somewhat intrusive as well, but there you go. You know, it's a true life crime story. Yeah. It's a Netflix original, so it will be on Netflix from the end of April, I think.
Okay, excellent. Demo.
I think for me, so the one film that I think definitely deserves a mention is God's Own Country, which we know has been picked up by Pitch House for the UK, so it doesn't have a date yet, but it will be released at some point this year. And it's a low budget British feature. It's another gay romance. It's set in the it's basically about a young sheep farmer in Yorkshire who makes this sort of unlikely connection with a Romanian, I think.
Yeah, a Romanian farmhand.
Farmhand who comes to work on his farm, and it won one of the directing awards at Sundance. And so Francis Lee is the director. It's a remarkable debut feature, and it means already being called the, you know, British Brokeback Mountain. And quite interestingly, it's very, you know, that it's. The dialogue is very broad Lancashire dialect, and in the screening in Berlin, they actually had English subtitles, which is something they often do with sort of Scottish movies. I'm not sure whether that will happen when it's released in the UK, but that was a really powerful, you know, breakout feature. And we do have some interesting low budget British movies that are coming out. Lady Macbeth is another one that's coming out soon. To look out for, and I think Francis Lee will be a strong voice for British cinema in the future.
Agreed. And there isn't a whole lot of dialogue, so nobody should be put off with the idea that they might not be able to.
Well, actually, maybe it's from I'm from the north, but I understood everything, you know, like Aurelia Nekin and stuff, and stuff like that. But I just think it was for international audiences, obviously, with English not being their first language.
Right, interesting that's out, and then you've also got Call Me By Your Name and things like Moonlight, but these kind of gay romances are being told in a way that doesn't sort of marginalise or...
Post-gay, that's what a producer friend said to me. She's called it post-gay. We don't have to, you know, kind of conversation about, you know,
it's
sort
not
of
the
gay
film.
It's not the gay film.
Yeah.
Though both Call Me By Your Name and God's Own Country have both been labelled as Brokeback.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I guess that just shows how long it has been since, you know...
Definitely. I think it's definitely a very positive thing because, you know, these films aren't being pigeonholed as gay titles. You know, they have a lot more going to them. Moonlight's a really good example. And the distributor didn't shy away from the gay storyline. Obviously, it's central to the film. And if anyone's listening to this and hasn't seen it, I urge you must go and see it as soon as possible. Three of the films that we've talked about today have sort of strong gay issues, but I wouldn't for one minute marginalise them for that reason.
I think they're just the stories, and I think all the films that we've spoken about, you know, have the love story at the heart of it, which is absolutely recognisable, and anybody who, you know, has been in love, been attracted to someone, you can identify with.
Sure.
So I really especially love that God's Own Country, they just didn't, there was no fuss about the sexuality of the character. I mean, his sort of isolation comes from living on the farm and having to sort of stay there rather than, you know, that his you know, rather than from his sexuality. So it was good, bold.
Okay, and then one quick final film to talk about, which I haven't yet, is Sally Potter's The Party.
Yeah, which is a really interesting one. I mean, Sally Potter is an interesting director, and she hasn't made a film for 5 years now. Ginger and Rosa was her last movie. She's probably better known for Orlando, The Tango Lesson, and this is sort of like a return to her, she's back on the scene now with The Party, which is a really bold and interesting movie. I mean, it's 71 minutes, so it's very, you know, very quick. Running time, it's shot in black and white, and the action all takes place in this one house, and the party in question is a celebration of Kristin Scott Thomas. She's just been found out that she's been appointed a minister in the shadow cabinet, and her friends are coming to visit her to congratulate her. It has a terrific cast: Bruno Ganz, Patricia Clarkson, Emily Mortimer, Cillian Murphy, Timothy Spall, and so, you know, UK audiences are going to be very excited by those names on the billboard. And it's sort of a comedy of manners in a way. I mean, it's in a way it reminded me of Abigail's Party.
Okay.
Basically, there's a series of disclosures. It's difficult to talk about it without spoiling it. But Timothy Spall has this everybody has something that they need to sort of, either a secret that's going to be exposed or something, or an announcement they want to make, and so it's full of sort of twists and turns, and it went down really well. I mean, people were in fits of laughter, and there was a standing ovation screen I was in, and I think it's very brave of her to return with a film that doesn't, you know, conform, you know, not even running time, and the fact that it's in black and white as well, and I think, you know, hopefully that one will make it to UK screens at some point in the next year or so.
It's very enjoyable. It's really sort of quite fast paced. It's got cracking dialogue. You know, it's liberalists, academics, feminists. What more could anybody want from a movie? Kristin Scott Thomas and Patricia Clarke, I think, have a great. You believe in their friendship, and I certainly watching it, I realised how rarely I see two older women talking to each other on screen about just stuff.
Yeah, and Patricia Clarkson's character is absolutely hilarious.
She's got some great one-liners. So. And obviously I think that it at 71 minutes it doesn't outstay its welcome either.
No, not at all.
Excellent. I think we should see more films at 71 minutes.
I agree. Yeah, totally.
Okay, so last thing then, if you could just name your favourite film of the festival.
It's like asking to name.
Should we say it at the same time?
No, should we try?
Go on then. 1, 2, 3.
A fantastic woman.
Fantastic woman, yeah, both of us.
You did that. What? Yeah, it was. We can't recommend it highly enough.
Okay, and I know it's going to be hard to answer this question, but what can you see being sort of like a trend at next year's Berlin Festival? Like, what can you see coming out next year?
Yeah, so this is the thing I think that interests me, because as a sort of marketeer, you hope that you're at the kind of forefront of trying to see what might emerge as a sort of dialogue or something. And like we've already mentioned, there were a lot of politics on the red carpet in terms of a lot of statements. And I'm wondering if the statements are going to, you know, become reality in terms of people making films that are, you know, that have a political response to the sort of, you know, what they see as the confusion happening in the world now, whether it's overt or subversive, I don't know.
Yeah, so we're seeing at the moment sort of the sort of post-Trump, post-Brexit sort of reactions from filmmakers who are obviously the awards season in general, sort of every single awards ceremony. The creative people are using that as a platform to get their views across, and what we haven't seen yet is how that might work its way into the actual work and how. Yeah. Which presumably will inevitably will.
I believe it will. I believe that, I still believe in the kind of power of cinema, and that you all come together in one room and that you sort of experience and witness something at the same time as everyone else. And I think that filmmakers have this incredible, opportunity to present things which, allow us to see, unusual and original things, and hopefully, be a kind of antidote to all the stuff that, is happening that we don't like.
Excellent. So, Kate and Damien, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay, so a big thank you to Kate Grover and Damien Spendley for letting us record them there. Right, so time for our Curls on Home Cinema recommendations.
Surprisingly, my one for this week is It's Only the End of the World.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
If you go on there, we have Javier Dolan's personal collection.
Yep.
So he's films chosen by him, and those consist of Taste of Cherry, Good Will Hunting, Finding Vivian Maya, My Beautiful Laundrette, Spotlight, and Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah, so...
Good choices, though.
Yeah, very good. And also check out the rest of the interview that we did with him in the projection booth. He talks about Everybody Wants Some, and he talks about how much he loves Titanic as well. So do check that out. Right, so I think that's it for this week. Must say thank you to CSR for letting us use their space as usual. Thanks a lot for joining us. Say goodbye, Sam.
Au revoir.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.